Today is a big day at Solace Church. This week is a big week, and then next Sunday is a big Sunday for us as well. And I want to say thank you for being here today. This is week two of our series called The Exodus. We are leaving this building in the near future and moving to a new campus, which everyone's excited about that at some level. But there's some things we need to learn along the way so that we make the move with success, that we don't just transfer to a new building and we begin to flounder. We want to flourish, we want to excel, and we want to make a significant impact. And so we're studying the story of the Exodus in the Bible to learn what they did wrong so that we don't have to repeat their mistakes, but also learn what they did right so that we can add and build onto the wisdom that they demonstrated during the Exodus. So last week, here's what we talked about. We said that Joseph moved to Egypt. His family, his generation died. A new generation emerged. And a new generation brought new challenges. And the principle that we learned is, past successes aren't always future successes. And past successes sometimes can become next generation burdens. And so we talked about how to prepare ourselves for next generation ministry. We just scratched the surface of that total introduction. Today, we're going to take another step on this journey. Now, we covered the first 14 verses last week. We're going to start in verse 15 today. But I want you to understand, for those of you who look at the book of Exodus and you're like, that's a whole bunch of chapters. Are we going verse by verse, Pastor? The good news, no, we're not going to cover every single verse in Exodus because we don't have time in this series, and because along the way, if I covered every single verse in Exodus, you would fall asleep, honestly, because some of it is very, very challenging to get through, and so on Sunday morning, we're not going to cover every single one of the verses. However, we're going to cover some major points. So, but for today, let's look at verse 15 as we pick up the story. Now, remember, Joseph and his family, his generation died, a new generation emerges. There's this hard labor that Pharaoh places on them. But the more they are oppressed, the more they multiply. Great principle of Scripture as well. And then verse 15, Pharaoh raises the stakes. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah, when you help the Hebrew women in childbirth and observe them on the delivery stool, if it's a boy, kill him. If it's a girl, let her live. The midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. So then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live? The midwives answered Pharaoh, the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. They're vigorous. And they give birth before the midwives arrive. Because Hebrew and Egyptian women are so much different, right? Because there's such a great variance between the two. So God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous, and because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people. Every boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live. This is pretty powerful as it relates to the intensifying of the warfare that's taking place. You have these people in Egypt multiplying, they become numerous, and so they are pressed hard with labor. That does not solve the problem, and so the next level of intensity is to tell the Hebrew midwives, if they recognize when the child is being born, that it is a boy, they should kill that child before it is fully delivered. In essence, it's abortion. So these Hebrew midwives who fear God aren't willing to follow Pharaoh's orders. They come up with this plan. It's pretty clever. These women are fast. That baby just pops out before we can get there. Truth of the matter is, these Hebrew midwives were risking their lives for disobeying this order from Pharaoh. But God was gracious to them, so gracious to them that he actually provided families for them because of their willingness to fear God above fearing Pharaoh. Pharaoh is certainly not pleased with what has taken place. The nation of Israel, Hebrew people, are growing even more numerous in Egypt. And so Pharaoh again ups the ante. He says to all of his people, if you see a Hebrew boy, young child, throw him into the Nile. In essence, drown him. If you see a girl, she can live. Now, this is very difficult for us to process. I get that. It seems very, very non-politically correct. It's interesting what happens with Pharaoh. It's a principle that all of us today need to learn. All of us need to understand about the way life works. When there is momentum or something of significance that is about to happen, one of the strategic, tactical approaches to keeping that something from happening is to destroy the male influence on a family, on a church, on a society, you name it. Now, I want you to think about this for a moment. Why was Pharaoh interested in doing away with males who were born in the Hebrew families? I think, first of all, it's for population control. I mean, just quite honestly, if you take a normal death rate in a society, if you take out 50% of births, which is roughly what it is in the world today, 50% male, 50% female, or close to that, then at the just regular death rate in any society, you would decrease the population of the Israelites over a period of a couple of decades, which is certainly what Pharaoh wanted to do. He was tired of the Hebrew people outnumbering or trying to outnumber the Egyptian people. I think the other thing that Pharaoh was trying to do is honestly just create a scare tactic approach, which is when you begin to kill people for no reason just because you want to, that creates a level of fear and anxiety within any kind of nation. And so who would go about revolting against the Egyptian people if your own children are being killed? But I think there was a more sinister plot behind Pharaoh's tactics. I actually think Pharaoh was interested in genocide. Follow me. You kill every male born, and then 20 years, 30 years from now, there are no Hebrew men to marry Hebrew women. So who are they going to marry? Egyptian men. Therefore, the entire Hebrew people within a generation could be wiped out entirely, and they would become Egyptians in essence, therefore doing away with these Hebrew nuisance called the Israelites. Follow me. When there is momentum or significance on the line, there is an all-out assault on men. This happened in Jesus' day as well. Do you know that? There is this announcement from angels to shepherds. There's the Messiah that's been born. He's been born in Bethlehem. You should go see it. Go tell everybody. This is an incredible event. There is this buzz, this excitement in the nation of Israel once again. This is really, really amazing. Has the Messiah come? Herod gets word of this potential Messiah being born in Bethlehem. He sends magi or wise men to see what's taking place. And he says, make sure I know where this Messiah is so that I can come and worship him. Sinister plot. I want to kill him. The Magi deceive Herod. They do not do what he asked him to do. Herod finds out about this deception, and so he issues this edict or order. All children in Bethlehem under the age of 2 should be killed. Why? Because Herod did not want something of significance, whatever it was, to be carried out. He wanted to stop it before it could reach its full fulfillment. And that is a strategic approach that takes place time and time again throughout history. And I'm going to tell you this today, church. It's a strategic approach in spiritual warfare in churches all the time. I would suggest to you that it's happened in our church and our ministry as well. In the last 9 years, God has grown a ministry and a church to several hundred, 600 or so. And that's been incredible. But what's about to happen in a new location, or the potential of what's about to happen, is way bigger than hundreds. We could be impacting thousands and thousands of people. Hear me. When that's on the line, you better understand that Satan is going to do everything he can to destroy male influence within this church, within our families, quite honestly, within a nation for that matter. Because when you take out male influence, you limit the success or the ability for whatever that was that's going to happen to find its fulfillment. So, look at our church and ministry. A couple of years ago, we started a campaign to raise money to build a new building. And that went exceptionally well, by the way. Except that there were significant spiritual attacks that took place on families that stepped up and tried to give. Not surprised about that. When you step up, try to invest yourself in something significant, there's always spiritual warfare attached to that. But even more specifically, when we started a construction team to start building that project, we asked some people who had some construction experience to come on board with us, and they graciously accepted that. But I said to every one of them, before we get started, you didn't understand this, when you step up and serve and leadership at a church, you better get ready because your family and your business and your life will be under attack. It just will. That's the nature of the beast. And lo and behold, within our ministry and our church, we had an individual who was on that construction team who had significant family issues. Marriage struggled significantly because I think as a direct result of him stepping up and leading within the ministry of a church. We had another individual come and serve in a construction capacity or construction team member capacity, and his business came under significant attack. I mean, they went through financial stuff and business stuff that would just shake anyone to his or her core. Other individuals on our construction team went through significant personal struggles as well. I mean, it's the nature of stepping up and leading in ministry. It just happens. So I want you to understand this. Dads, men in the church today, you need to get this. By you being a part of this right here, I would not be surprised if you're not experiencing or will experience some significant warfare. I'm not saying you're not going to win. I'm just saying you better be ready because it's coming. Because if you take the male influence, you affect the family, you affect a society, you affect a church. Now, it's very interesting. Years ago in Africa, there was a problem that a specific village faced. There was a herd of elephants that grew so large that they endangered the human population in the area in that village. They were causing some mischief, causing some problems, and so the people in that area decided, let's bring in some experts to try to figure out what to do. One of the things that they did is they isolated and took out of the herd all the young teen bull elephants in the herd because they didn't want the population growing again, and so they removed all of them out of the herd to try to break up the herd to try to minimize the effects of this growing herd. So they removed all the teen bull elephants out of that and moved them to a new location apart from the herd. It's interesting what happened. That group of teen bull elephants started acting like a gang. They became incredibly mischievous. They destroyed crops. They damaged homes. They even began to kill people, which is not normal for an elephant to do. I mean, they are very, very destructive teenagers. So by trying to remedy one problem, they created a brand new problem in this area. So these teen bulls are ganged up together, teen bull elephants ganged up together, destroying the area, and they've now got this incredible problems on their hand. And so they call on these experts, and they say, how are we going to fix this problem? So the experts come up with all these different ideas about how to fix this teenage bull elephant gang problem. But none of the ideas worked. One person came up with the idea, let's talk to a village chief, someone that's been here, done that, seen all the dynamics for years and years and years. And so they go to this old African village chief and they ask him, what are we going to do about this problem? And he said, it's easy. He said, go find an older male bull elephant and send him to where these teenagers are. And so they airlifted, helicoptered in this bull elephant into where these teenage bull elephants were located, and they dropped him off. This old bull elephant went into the woods, and for weeks he was never seen. A couple of weeks later, though, they saw him emerging from the trees, and behind him in single file line were these teenage bull elephants. They never had a problem again with those teen bull elephants in that village. Because that's the nature of humanity and society and the world that God created. Because male influence is significant. Now, some of you ladies in here this morning might say, well, that sounds like a very chauvinistic message you're preaching, Pastor. I'm kind of offended. And I'm not saying you don't serve a significant role. I'm just simply recognizing what God's word has already said is true. That men, you are called to lead, provide, protect. That's just what the Bible calls us to. I came across an article that I think is really, really interesting. It comes from the Huffington Post. Now, I'm going to be real honest with you. I don't read the Huffington Post. For those of you who follow politics, that might speak a lot about my political persuasions. But I don't typically read the Huffington Post all that often. But this article was on there about men, the influence they have in society. And I thought it was so good I would share it with you this morning. Because again, if you can take out male influence, you cause societies, families, churches to suffer. This is what the article says. I'll make sure I get all the pages. This is good stuff. This article was written by a lady by the name of Francesca Biller Saffron, or probably Saffron, a female, by the way. This is what she writes. Fathers matter more than ever, and anyone who doubts their importance has inevitably never endured life without one. Even feminist Gloria Steinem said, most American children suffer too much mother and too little father. The politically correct modern notion is that as long as a child is healthy and loved, it doesn't matter who they are raised and nurtured by. And of course, if there's no father, any loving parent is integral for a child's well-being, to which I think we could all agree that if the father is just absent because of death, then the mother has to step up, and we get that. But the male influence in a child's life is invaluable, irreplaceable, and necessary. And she writes, there I said it. As politically incorrect as it may sound, fathers are important, and it would do us all good to reflect on where we might be without the great male influence that our fathers have bestowed on our lives. While it's true that we all need the unique love and nurturing only a mother can give, we also need dads more than ever, and more of the old-fashioned kind. Thankfully, she writes, I grew up in an era where men were allowed to be fathers without being chastised for being too manly or strong. Many children today unfortunately miss out on the invaluable experience of loving, strong fathers who don't feel the need to apologize for being male and all the characteristics that come along with them. Some of them wonderful, some of them not so wonderful, but most necessary for balance, tenacity, and maturity. Former New York Governor Mario Cuomo said, I talk and talk and talk, and I haven't taught people in 50 years what my father taught by example in 1 week. The author goes on to say, my dad carried with him a lot of acerbic wit, and often we couldn't tell if he was serious or not. I will never forget the feeling when he got home each day. As kids, we were excited by his arrival, but also knew rules definitely were in strict order when he walked through the doors. Call it child abuse, but we were not allowed to talk over him or my mother. When they spoke, it meant they actually had something to say, and we needed to be quiet. Mark Twain said, when I was a boy of 14, my father was so ignorant I could hardly stand to have the old man around. But when I got to be 21, I was astonished at how much he had learned in 7 years. She goes on to say, fathers often encourage us to try something new, even when some moms warn that we might get hurt emotionally or physically. It's that perfect mix of caution and grit we need in order to become well-balanced adults. Fathers usually encourage us to take the training wheels off our bicycles, as well as applying for that job we never thought we could get. And when we fall off our bikes and don't get the dream job, a simple pat answer of, you'll ace it next time, kid, is just what we need to hear. The article continues, my father used to play with, and this is a quote, my father used to play with my brother and me in the yard, said Harmon Killebrew, an American baseball player. My mother would come out and say, you're tearing up the grass. We're not raising grass, Dad would say, we're raising boys. Comedian Father Bill Cosby said, always end the name of your child with a vowel, so that when you yell, the name will carry. We've got a Grady and a Graham, and I can tell you that is true. Grady, Graham, this doesn't work so well, does it? On a more serious note, she writes, she notes that Cosby would be the first to admit that growing up without a father is no laughing matter. A recent poll shows that more than 70% of the U.S. population thinks the most significant social problem in this country is that so many children grow up without fathers. A house without a father is a challenge, writes Cosby in his book, Fatherless Children. A neighborhood without fathers is a catastrophe. That's just about what we have today. Why is the problem so grave? A mother can usually teach a daughter how to be a woman, but as much as mothers love their sons, they have difficulty showing a son how to be a man. We can't speak honestly of black culture in America until we honestly address the issue of the estrangement of fathers and their children, she writes. And statistics for both boys and girls prove this theory to be more fact than conjecture. For example, an adolescent white female growing up in an advantaged background is 5 times more likely to become a teen mother if she grows up without a father in the home. The picture is even grimmer for boys who grow up without dads present in the home. Psychiatrists say that many fatherless boys are motivated by displaced anger. According to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the National Center for Health Statistics, fatherless children are at a dramatically greater risk of drug and alcohol abuse, mental illness, suicide, poor education performance, teen pregnancy, and criminality. And in a study conducted by the Consortium for the Study of School Needs of Children, from one-parent families, children with fathers at home tend to do better in school, are less prone to depression, and are more successful in relationships. However, children from one-parent families achieve less and get in trouble more than children from two-parent families. She goes on to say nearly 80% of all rapists are reported to have grown up in fatherless homes. For both boys and girls, 90% of all homeless and runaway children are from fatherless homes, as well as 75% of all adolescent patients in chemical abuse centers are from homes without fathers. You get the point. Sigmund Freud writes, "I cannot think of any need in childhood as strong as the need for a father's protection." She finishes the article by saying, "Now that we are all sobered about these figures, the good news is that fathers are beginning to get a better rap on a lot of fronts. The pendulum of public opinion is starting to swing, as well as ridiculture that suggests fathers are unimportant and valueless, which will prove valuable to the next generation of would-be fathers and mothers. The politically incorrect notion that men don't matter in children's lives is beginning to be said out loud without much argument from either the pop psyche or psych culture and from those who claim that dads matter little in the lives of children. Similarly, the idea that men can only be good fathers if they act like women is also looked on as preposterous and counterproductive, and I say amen to that. The view that a strong male influence can easily be displaced or replaced is fortunately losing its ground, with more women and men realizing the profundity of fathers as role models and teachers for all children and for the betterment of communities and society as a whole. The last thing she says, which is a little bit sarcastic, she says, "The worst thing that can happen is we wake up from years of emasculating and ignoring the male father role as integral and necessary is that more children," it's the worst thing that could happen, she says, "is that more children will one day be able to wish their own dads at home a happy Father's Day." We are facing an epidemic of men who are usurping their responsibility in the home, in the church, and in the society. That's just the reality of where we're at. And the reason why is because there is spiritual warfare that is taking place. I am convinced that people and principalities and powers of this dark world understand that if they can take you out of the church and you out of the family, they can destroy a church, a family, and a society. That's the reality of the world we live in. So guys, I'm asking you today to come alongside me and understand that you play a significant role in this journey. And I'm asking you today, what are you doing to support and build up healthy families, your family, healthy churches, our church, and a healthy nation? What are you doing with that? How are you handling that responsibility? I'll tell you quickly about what happened in my life a couple of months ago that has been absolutely life-changing for me. In July, I took what's called a sabbatical, which is just simply time away from the church, consistent time away from the church. I took 21 days off in July. It's the longest I had been away from this church ever since we started it, and that was a significant investment on my part to be away. The good news about that is that I have a church family that gets that and appreciates that. And I just want to say to you, thank you for giving me that time away. I needed it. In those 21 days, I spent time with my wife. We went on vacation with our family. We spent time just hanging out, doing the whole family thing. And it was great. I didn't come to church, and I didn't worry about it. I had other guys preach, other guys lead in ministry. And I'm so thankful for our staff that they were able to do that. I'm thankful for that. So during those 21 days, I was refreshed physically. It was really, really good. And I thought during those 21 days that I was going to receive this like light from heaven moment from God. Like in these 21 days of sabbatical, God's just going to give me this brand new thing that I never heard before. So 21 days passed, really not anything of much significance, spiritually speaking. I had started doing a devotion before July. It's this blue book that I have. I didn't have a name. It didn't have a title. It's the only book I've ever read that has no title at all. I couldn't even tell you where to get it. A guy gave it to me, a coach gave it to me, and I started reading this devotional. One of the first days I read one of these devotionals, I felt like God spoke to me. This is before July. I felt like God said to me, I'm so excited to be going on this journey with you. There's so much I've been wanting to tell you. And that was really cool to hear. So I did it sporadically through the July sabbatical. It was off and on. It wasn't consistent at all. But the Sunday before I went back to work that next Monday morning, something happened in my life. It was late. I knew I was going to, I was excited about getting back to church because I missed being here, because I love being here. And that night I just began to talk to God, just to pray. It wasn't anything like on my knees or in a closet. I mean, just laying in bed before I went to sleep. And in that moment I felt like God said to me this: it gets tougher from here. And the next thing I heard God say to me, I think, was, and I don't want you to get hurt. Now that was different for me, because the way I view my relationship with God is that I would expect God to say, it gets tougher from here, and I don't want you to hurt my church. Because I see my role as pastor as critical for you, and I want to be a great servant to you, and my role is critical in the whole dynamic of things. But God was personal with me. I'm interested in you individually first. You, Dad. You, Matt. You, my child. And one of the very next things I heard from God was, me and you, every morning, 6 a.m. Now, I don't know how many of you know me personally. Like we've hung out, you know a little bit about my schedule. But this was earth-shattering to hear this from God. Like world-rocking stuff. Because when I started the church, I'm just being real honest with you this morning, when I started the church, there were a lot of times that I stayed up till like midnight, 1, 2, and sometimes 3 o'clock in the morning. And I could sleep till 10, 11 o'clock because there was very few people to pastor and not a whole lot to do. If you're starting a church or in ministry and you have a church of 30, 40, 50 people, I know what it takes to pastor that many people, and it doesn't take a whole lot of time and effort and energy. It just doesn't. And so I had all this time. And let me, how many of you know that when you have a lot of free time, that's not a good thing? I faced significant spiritual warfare in those early days. My marriage came under significant attack. The ministry came under significant attack. My personal life came under significant attack. It was really intense. I've always felt like 8:30 is a good wake-up time. Anybody else in my world? Come on, man. Why 6? Why 5? And I felt like God said, me and you every day, 6 o'clock in the morning. And I was thinking in my mind, you mean Saturday too? Saturday too. Every day. Every day. Every day until you die. And that was huge for me. And so I'm going to unpack more of what took place in a couple of those early days in another message coming up. But I began to meet with God every day, 6 a.m., with this blue book, with my Bible, with my iPhone, playing worship music during that time, reading scripture, going through this devotion. And one of the key things that I began to do was pray as well. Now, please hear me. God's not legalistic. I haven't gotten up at 6 a.m. every single day. I've hit the snooze a couple of times, just being honest. And then there was a day that I missed totally. I forgot to set the alarm, so I wasn't up, and God did not strike me dead. You know, this is not about legalistic righteousness. It's about consistency in a relationship with God. But I would do this every single day. Now, we've just now moved into my parents' house. But we lived in a rent house previous to that. That's right, building a church, getting ready to build a house, moved in with my parents. That's awesome right there. I mean, they're wonderful people, but chaos abounds in my life right now. So every morning I begin to get up, 6, begin to do this devotion, study, pray. And one of the things that I felt like that I needed to do for my own personal time. I've got this afghan, and it's been knitted. It's got little holes throughout the whole thing, and then at the end it's got these little pieces of yarn that are like little hair deals. You got string deals. You got the picture, right? They're knotted together. And I felt like for me, it was important for me when I prayed to get on my knees and to cover my body with this afghan. It just for me symbolized the covering of the blood of Christ. It's red, and so it just for me was a picture of covering, and so I would pray with this covered over my head. I don't think I'm weird. That's just my personal deal. I'm not asking you to do that, all right? That's just for me. You can do whatever you feel led to do. So I would get on my knees and pray. But here's the thing. My son Grady gets up every day sometime around 6 to 6:30 every day of his life. And I'm not kidding you. Every day, unless he is deathly ill, he is up in the morning. In the rent house, there was my bedroom, there was a living room, a dining room, one bathroom, and one other bedroom, and the kitchen was there as well. I mean, it was a small house. And every day, Grady would get up right in the middle of my devotion. Oftentimes, and I'd be praying, and he would get up, and he would say, "Dad, I'm hungry, I'm thirsty, can I have something to drink? Can I watch a movie?" And I'm like, "Kid, do you not know what I'm doing right now? I'm meeting with Jesus. Go back to bed." When Grady's up, he's up. He never goes back to sleep. I mean, I've hardly ever gotten him back to sleep every day. He would come in on a regular basis and mess up my time with Jesus. And I'd have to take off this afghan. I'd have to go get him milky or go get him and then go to a different room in the house. And there was no place to go do this. I'm like, "God, do you not? You asked me to get up to do this, and you're not giving me an opportunity to go meet with you. This is not going to work. You're going to have to fix the problem for me." And then one morning, something incredible happened. I was wrapped up in that afghan, kneeling down on my couch, praying, and I heard the footsteps that I heard many, many mornings before. And this morning, Grady didn't ask me for milk or juice. He came and he knelt down beside me. I took that afghan and I wrapped it around him. He began to pray. He's four. He began to pray, "Father, Father, we love you. And if you ever leave us, we'll never leave you." Now, his theology is terrible. Awful. That's not even close to how the Bible says it is. In that moment, it didn't matter. Because what I thought was a nuisance for days and days and days, it was actually a model for my son to see Jesus. I'm so thankful for the privilege of showing him that there is a God who loves him, who longs to do great things through him. And every dad in this room and every male in this room has a responsibility to lead their families to the throne room of God, pray over them and protect them so that their family might be whole, so that this church might be whole. Because I'm telling you, what is about to happen in this ministry is incredible. And guys, if we don't have you, we're going to suffer. So can I ask you today this question? What are you doing in your family right now to lead them with spiritual integrity, with power, with protection over them? Today, I hope you're encouraged, but more than that, I hope that you are led to do some things practically in your families. For years and years and years, I taught at Solace Church, you don't need a consistent time with God, you just need a time, sometime in the course of a week or a month with God. But I'm telling you today, that's not it. You need to be with him every single day. When I'm with Jesus at 6 a.m. in the morning, from 6 to whatever it is in the morning, I come into church a different person. Because at 6 a.m., Jesus is telling me, "I love you, and I believe in you, and I have plans for you." And by 9 a.m., when our office doors open, I am ready and excited with an assurance and a confidence and a peace that exists within me that doesn't happen if I just run here and get going and not spend that time with Jesus. I'm telling you, it's life-changing for you to do. So, fathers, what are you doing? Would you come with me on this journey? Hear me. In this church right now, our young people, our kids need you. They need you to be in classrooms leading them. Our teenagers need you. They need you to be with them, modeling before them Christ. 40-somethings, 50-somethings, men in here, the 20-somethings desperately need you. They need you to help them make it through these critical years of raising a family and having a marriage. Would you come alongside of us and lead with us? I want you to bow your heads and close your eyes this morning.
Hey, this is Pastor Matt Blair. Thank you so much for taking time to check out our podcast today at solacechurch.com. You know, we realize that it's possible, as you listen to this message today, that God may have spoken to your heart about something. So if you made any kind of spiritual decision, we would love to know about that. You can email us at info@solacechurch.com and let us know what happened in your life today. Once again, thank you so much for taking time to check out this podcast.